Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This episode of Pardes Live and Miniseries features Rav Mike Foyer. For more information on how to download more podcasts, visit elmod.pardes.org.
Okay, as always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. And just a quick reminder, please, guys, to turn off the ringers on your cell phones. And before we get started, it's always important to remember that the learning we do is not just a power to change ourselves, but it really has a magnifying effect in the world. And our tradition teaches that it could even bring healing. So I want to dedicate everything that may be said or learned here to the refuah shlema of Matityahu ben Yochanan. Should be healthy and well. This should only be good news. Okay. So we are in the midst of this conversation about the aftermath of the expulsion. We're going to be here for a while, as I warned you. Just to remember, in the big picture, there are a number of directions geographically that the exiles will go. Into the new world, we'll discuss that side of the story mostly when we get to the full discussion of the conversos, and in particular, the Portuguese, the Hebrews of the Portuguese nation, but known as the Nacio. So they lie ahead. There's the spread into continental Europe, right, quite a bit. Italy is where we're focused now, and I want to kind of wrap up the Italian story for now today. But also Amsterdam is going to be a very important city for us. And then, of course, the Ottoman Empire. I am inclined to go there next. I think that the next place that we'll be headed will be the holy city of Sfat, just because it's so much fun and it's a very rich story. And it's also, in my experience, provides a background for a lot of knowledge that people already have that may not be grounded into the historical narrative, which is what I love to do. So just to pick up the threads from where we were, the last conversation that we were having was about the historian, somewhat in quotes, Shlomo Ibn Verga, right, was a direct experiencer, there's a word, but he experienced the exile directly. And we spoke about this flowering of historiography, of the need to tell the story of history as one of the, if not primary, at least most remarkable responses to the expulsion. Right? And I want to just really drive home the critical point there, that up until this point in the Jewish story, those of us who have been together for a while, we've been hammering away at this notion of mipnei chataeinu galinu me'artzeinu. Because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. Now, when you say that to most people today, there's a sense of Jewish guilt. Like I've told you guys, like the whole scene in Annie Hall. I'm not going to repeat myself. But it's important to remember that before that became a hallmark of Jewish guilt, it was a whole theory of the maintenance of historical agency. That liturgical phrase is an assertion which is rooted in our sages' worldview that what happens to the Jewish people is a result of our actions. So that when the Second Temple was destroyed, which is when this sort of phase of history that we're speaking about begins, it wasn't actually the Romans who destroyed it. Yes, true, the sort of wood and stone structure was torched by Titus and his men, but who destroyed the Second Temple? The Jews. And therefore, who will rebuild it? The Jews. And not with, in the rabbinic mind, the classic tools of national agency. Not necessarily through economy, politics, army, all these vehicles of national agency. Now, it's interesting, you can already probably hear, those of you who had a good Zionist education, the clash to come. Because what we're going to see is that the rabbinic class and the religious culture within which they're embedded is going to double down on this notion that it is the religious actions of Am Yisrael which drive Jewish history. The historical perspective says what? What do we say Ibn Verga took out of the scientific and the philosophical models and sort of was one of the first Jews to apply to historical research? What? No, Spinoza actually will read it. Causality. This idea of natural causality. That, you know, all the Jews, and we'll speak more about this when we get to the scientific revolution, at this point, all the Jews say there's nothing heretical about saying what goes up must come down. And you'd think, what could possibly be heretical about that? Is it really true that what goes up must come down? What goes up usually comes down? What goes up almost always... I will agree that every time I've seen something goes up, it comes down, but don't tell me that it must. Because that's what's called the occasionalist perspective. It's the opposite of causality. That why does it come down? No, because God said so. Because God said so, right? Meaning these are two very different worldviews, which you see in the Middle Ages, particularly amongst what are known as the Mutakallimun, a subset of Islamic philosophers who have a deep influence on Jewish medieval thought, that actually what goes up mustn't necessarily come down. What goes up comes down because God wants it to. That what we consider to be natural law, which is based on this idea of causality, is potentially heretical. Because if it must come down, what if God doesn't want it to? What happens then? Yeah? Indeed, the classic Jewish view is the interim view, which is the Rambam, who fully believed in the idea of the laws of nature, did not limit God's capacity to create or act, but he believed that God created a system in which everything functions, what goes up indeed must come down, right? Except in very particular cases, which we call what?
Miracles,
which is why we will see when we get to Spinoza in particular that the question of the miraculous is one of the sort of most difficult questions in the reconciliation between a scientific philosophical worldview and a religious worldview. Meaning, we can all agree on God as creator, that's easy, right? At least in the Middle Ages and most of early modernity, it was relatively easy. But God as micromanager, right? Whether it's through the miraculous in the national scale, or what we call sort of divine providence in the personal scale, this idea which will come central to Jewish thought much later, that the Kabbalists will really make central, and really that Hasidut will bring deeply into culture, right? Not a leaf but falls from a tree without the will of God, which is actually a paraphrase of a Puritan preacher in America in the 17th century, but it could have been said by the Baal Shem Tov. That worldview doesn't work with classic historical analysis. So therefore, why is Ibn Verga matter? Because the idea that because of our sins, we were exiled from our land is a divine micromanagement worldview. I mean, why on earth would laying tefillin or shaking a lulav have anything to do with regaining national sovereignty? Well, right, you understand then what really matters is not the events of history. What really matters is the actions of the Jews. And if the events of history matter, it's only insofar as they are a fulfillment of what? God's will, and particularly God's promises as read through the words of the prophets. And that's what we spoke about, that the opposite view of the historical worldview is the prophetic worldview, at least in this context. I wouldn't want to put them totally opposition. But in this context, you'll have some Jews who will come out of Spain. I read you that piece from the Barbanel last week. If you guys remember, that the Barbanel was reading the prophecies in the book of Devarim and saying, oh, our current national experience is reflective of a fulfillment of the words of Devarim. And because of that, what's on the horizon? Yeah, the Messiah, Gula, redemption, right? And so this sort of way of viewing the events, whereas Ibn Verga was trying to understand, well, just like Machiavelli, who was his contemporary, he said, well, I'll tell you exactly why Ferdinand did it. Because it was good, he thought, economic policy, it was good social policy, because he wants to be the most Catholic monarch in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. Homogeneous populace is easier to unify law, and it made all kinds of sort of rational, realpolitik reasons. But Ibn Verga was a religious Jew. He wasn't denying God. What he was dealing with was an indigestible problem. Because what on earth could the Jews have done to have deserved this? Now, he never quite says it, although he says, wherefore such wrath? And I told you, he brought some uncomfortable answers. This is the superiority of the Jews, right, and our refusal to mix with the non-Jews. These are themes that will continue and repeat themselves. That's why I'm a bit repeating it now. Right? But more than anything else, I just want you to take away from that, that the historical worldview is a beginning of a break with the traditional rabbinic worldview. Because it puts God on the shelf. Now, there's the interim position. Well, God is working through causality, fine, but you know what? That's already one step out the door, as we'll see in modernity. But Ibn Verga and his contemporaries, as we spoke about, eight different works of historiography, none of which really, well, we may actually look at the Me'orei Naim, which is another Azariah de Rossi's work in the later 16th century. We'll see what happens when we get there. It's an interesting There's a whole interesting story around it, but their impact is negligible. The flowering of historiography that happens in the immediate wake of the expulsion lacks impact, largely because the culture, meaning Jewish traditional culture, was unable to receive it. Right? On some levels, unable to receive it because there wasn't the intellectual sort of development and cultivation that would allow for its reception. Jews were pretty traditional and were pretty wedded to the notion that it's our actions which matter in history. Why else do you think that it would have been difficult to receive? It makes it much harder to bear the suffering. Because if you tell me that my whole family was just killed or forcibly converted or scattered across the globe, and that the reason was that Ferdinand woke up one morning and decided this is just good policy, how on earth do I process that? Right? And this may be familiar to some of us, as we mentioned last class, that the parallels to how Jews in modernity, late modernity and post-modernity, are still struggling to process not the lessons of the Holocaust or its messages, that's like 100 years down the line, just the reality of it. How do you go on? Right? And the comparison is quite apt because, of course, if Ferdinand did what he did because of economic, social, political policy, you know what? He is not evil. He's not evil. Oh, he can be Machiavellian. But remember, that Machiavelli is offering a new definition of good. He's saying this whole moralist, philosophical stance, idealist stance of good is hooey. I'll tell you what's good. What's good is what works. This may sound familiar to many of us. And you know, here at ipso facto, if it works, it's good, and therefore it's good if it works. And therefore, Ferdinand was a good king. And you know what? A lot of Catholic citizens of Ferdinand's kingdom experienced him as a good king. And so therefore, for the Jews to give up on the existence of evil and the battle with it that allows a whole integrated worldview of how to experience our own suffering and understand it, that's a big price to pay. And so we're going to leave Ibn Verga for now, but I just do want to note to you is that, I'll give you one guess, I'll give you three, and the first two don't count. When will Jewish historiography make its comeback? 19th century, right, with a real encounter with modernity. Meaning, in many ways, Jewish historiography is a bookend for the historic experience of the Jews with modernity. There was a bit of a try. We're going to see that what actually happens is that our stance of modernity is the entire opposite, but in the end of the day, modernity proves too strong to just hold off with mythic thinking, at least for most of us. I'm doing just fine. Okay, so that's kind of like a bit of a review on the historical. Now what I want to talk about today really is the concept of cultural appropriation. You guys familiar with cultural appropriation? It's like a part of the language. So you got to hang out with the millennials more. The idea of cultural appropriation, I don't mean to mock actually, it's potentially problematic, although I actually don't think it is so much. It's the idea that if I decide to dress up as a samurai warrior on Halloween, how is it that Halloween became such a source of controversy? That I'm not just having fun, and I'm not just expressing my samurai side, I am somehow appropriating Japanese culture, and in that, I'm sort of accessing the power dynamic which exists between the white culture and Asian culture. And therefore, it is not a permissible act for me as a Jewish white American male, fill in the blank, to dress up as a samurai warrior. Okay, but you... Right, so follow the whole thing. You know, we're not going to politics. No, we don't talk politics here because it just gets me in trouble. But culture, I will shred culture. That's fun. But here's the thing. I can tell you, for the last 500 years, truth is, the last 2,000, there's been one culture that has been completely permissible to appropriate no matter who, when, or where you were. What's that culture? The Jews. I mean, you can claim to be the Jews, children of Israel. Remember, Christianity, in many ways, is the first large-scale identity theft that Western culture knows. It's the first large-scale identity theft that Western culture knows. We are the Jews. But hey, what about us? No, 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 no. This doesn't belong to you anymore. You know? And like, I grew up listening to reggae music. Anybody here ever listen to reggae music? Yeah, it's good. So the Rastafarians in Jamaica identify as the tribe of Judah and the children of Israel. That's really beautiful until you realize, isn't that my culture? I thought you weren't allowed to do that. So this idea, what? It was not Jewish. The Lee and Molly story. We can get into that back to, I see we have what to talk about. Anyway, I would be happy to have him as a member of the tribe. Don't get me wrong. So there's this phrase that the flip side of cultural appropriation is the incredible capacity the Jews have to assimilate. Right? Meaning, one explanation for why Jewish culture has been up for grabs for so long is because the Jews seem to be willy-nilly like, oh, you want it? Go for it. By the way, it hasn't worked out so well for us. You know, and are more than willing to sort of back away from our own culture, which is a challenge. And what we're going to see in sort of Renaissance humanism and its intersection with Jewish culture, that this is alive and well. Right? The other way to put this is there's always a tension in the Jewish story between the Jews are just like everyone else, only more so. Right? They will be more Greek than the Greeks, more Italian than the Italians, more German than the Germans, more American than Brooklyn. And on the other hand, we are the stranger amongst, right? We are the chosen people. We are somehow unique. And that tension doesn't go away. I would argue that it's an essential tension that as we go through our encounter with modernity, a lot of what's happening is happening on two fronts. How does the Jew fit with the non-Jew? That's what's known ultimately in modernity as the Jewish problem, right? And we're not there yet, although we'll see a couple of its pieces laid today. And the internal discourse, which is an identity discussion. Who are we? Are we just like everybody else, only more so? Is this the human story, or is this the Jewish story? And that's an internal tension, which I'm sure people are very familiar with. It's one of the fundamental tensions, by the way, between Israeli Jewry and American Jewry. I'm not talking about religious, not religious. I'm talking about the fact that Israel is an ethnic nation state, where democracy serves a secondary role to ethnic solidarity. That's the way it was designed from the beginning. America is a civic nation state in which the Jews are a minority culture seeking to exercise their rights as such. Those are two fundamentally different approaches to what it means to be a Jew. Again, I'm not saying one's better, worse. It's not my point. My point is that, yeah, the Jew, here, this is an ethnic nation state, the state of the Jewish people. So therefore, when we talk about a Jewish and democratic state, which is a lot of the tension here in Israel, well, what you're experiencing there is that democracy as a value doesn't jibe well with the ethnic nation state model. In the places where it's succeeded, it's because it's been a largely homogenous populace. So therefore, that's why a lot of the discourse here now is about whether democracy is a fundamental value or a utilitarian approach to governance. Because if the fundamental value is ethnic solidarity, then democracy will always bow to it. If the fundamental value is democratic sort of Western liberal norms, then the ethnic sort of value will have to bow to it. And so Americans approach that question with the assumption that democracy is the fundamental value, not just because they're liberal, but because as Jews, that's what allows for surviving and thriving as a minority culture within a civic nation state. You understand me? It has nothing to do with liberal conservative. It has to do with the fact that American Jews are an ethnic minority thriving in a civic nation state. Therefore, it makes sense when they're looking at what kind of looks like a civic nation state to say that should be the same value. But Israeli Jews are thriving as an ethnic majority in a, let's say, semi-democratic nation state. So that's a lot of the... There's not a lot of shared terminology. You want to share something?
So how do you think that the whole embrace of democracy is just a psychological reaction to the historical trauma of constant persecution?
The embrace of democracy is absolutely... I'm with you. I would say that each one is the attempt of a people to survive. And that kind of lies behind the tension that I just characterized. You have to remember, particularly in the wake of the expulsion or the Holocaust, right? The primary impetus of the Jews is a survival mode, right? And survival, while effective, does not necessarily lend itself to cultural flowering, to sort of like complexity of thought, to patience on a historical scale. So we're going to look at this period, but I think you're entirely correct that we should have one eye to the questions. I've told you guys before, I'm not actually interested in the past. I'm interested in what the past can teach us about how to live today and tomorrow. Yeah, we do, please, thanks. Okay, so where are we in time? We are in late 15th, early 16th century Italy, and what's happening in Italy at this point actually plays a very important role in the human story as well as the Jewish, which is that, you know, the medieval scholasticism that had sort of served as the intellectual framework for Europe for, say, 300 years or so at this point has started to break down, basically because it's being deemed narrow pedantry. It's a self-referential system of thought, largely based on Aristotelian philosophy and certain theology of the church, right? Furthermore, there's a scientific worldview which is being chipped away at that goes along with medieval thought, what's known as Ptolemaic, both geography and ultimately astronomy. Copernicus is on the horizon, right? We're going to start challenging the notion that the Earth is at the center of the universe. Not yet, we'll talk about it. But meaning the old view of the Middle Ages, which is embodied, particularly in the church, is in scholasticism, which places God at the top, has a medieval hierarchy from God to humanity, well, God to the church, to the rest of the humanity, onwards, etc., is fraying at the edges. Why? Because there's a new wind blowing through Europe, which is known as humanism. Humanism, of course, puts what at the center of thought? Humanity. Not just humanity, but human experience. Right? We're not all the way into the Romantic era, but meaning it's not just a philosophical movement. It is also an artistic movement. It is a cultural movement where human experience, as opposed to God's divine intention, becomes critical. And therefore, there is a revival of classical learning, as we've discussed, Greco-Roman. Right, and it's important to note that the Jews will play a very good role in that, as we'll see in a second, but I want to give the definition of humanism first. And when you turn to the Greco-Roman classical works, you know what you'll find? A very strong stream of rationalism, right? Which the church was not, well, let's say it differently, that scholasticism, though it was logical, was not such a rationalist perspective. It was built on fundamental faiths, right? And those faiths were inviolate. And therefore, you could, what? Faiths, right? Like miracles, you know, the revelation at Sinai, of course, it was built on, but also Jesus as Son of God, meaning the logical, not just making stuff up, but these are not elements that are based in sort of empirical human experience and the conclusions one would draw from it. Whereas classical, at least late antiquity, Greco-Roman culture had a big strain of that, which in turn causes a lot of critical analysis of the very narrow horizons of the medieval church. This is what brings about humanism. I have a quote here. It's actually worth reading from the Cambridge Dictionary of Philosophy. So when you encounter humanist thought, here one felt no weight of the supernatural pressing on the human mind, demanding homage and allegiance. Humanity, with all its distinct capabilities, talents, worries, problems, possibilities, was the center of interest. It has been said that medieval thinkers philosophized on their knees, but bolstered by the new studies, they, meaning the humanists, dared to stand up and rise to full stature. Right? God is being pushed back. You understand? This is what we spoke about, one of the hallmarks of modernity, which is the expanding of the horizons of thought. Right? The lifting of our horizon makes you aware of what you don't know, which almost by definition will make you skeptical of anyone who's been telling you all along, this is all there is. You understand? And this is the context of humanism. It used to be on the edge of maps, there be dragons. Now, Vasugama says, no, there be India. You know? And it used to be that the church said, oh, you can't, that element of your human experience, be it aesthetic, sexual, emotional, whatever it is, that's beyond the pale. But now people who, anyway, were having those experiences begin to speak to each other with a freedom which makes them realize there's actually a critical area of study. And they feel bolstered by the recapturing of late antiquity, classical Greco-Roman culture. The Europeans will see that as their culture, which was erased by whom? The church. Oh, now you can see where this is going. Right? You're like, oh, they lied to me. You know? So what's interesting is, of course, is that when the humanists get up off their knees and begin to stand upright in order to philosophize, they notice the Jews in a very different light. Because aren't the Jews human too? So on one hand, this will be what we today call a liberal force in the relationship between Jew and non-Jew. On the other hand, it's not so easy to shake 1,500 years of Christian culture. So though they will be humanists, they are Christian humanists. In fact, at this point in Italy, it's within the Catholic Church that this humanist element emerges. And so therefore, I think rather than having a purely hypothetical discussion, I want to introduce to you a character of the Italian Renaissance, not a Jew, who actually plays a very interesting role, small but powerful, in Jewish history, which is Pico della Mirandola, right? It's got, can I spell that? Of course I can, by reading it off the paper. He has another, like, first name. What do you say? Like, you can't have more than, like, two or three names, in my opinion, but Mirandola. He's a count, young nobleman, precocious by all accounts, from a very young age, already mastering the translations of classical antiquity. It's important, actually, to note as a sidelight, which we spoke about last year, is that many of the works of particularly Aristotelian philosophy that make their way into the hands of, you know, these young humanists were preserved originally in what language? Well, Greek originally, and then they made their way from Greek into Arabic, right? And often from Arabic into Hebrew, and then from Hebrew into Latin. And there are other routes, but that was a common one. Yes, but you know, scholastics like Thomas Aquinas, probably the best known Aristotelian scholastic, so you're talking about 13th century, where did he learn Aristotle? Largely from the works of Averroes, who was an Arabic thinker, and it seems from a lot of evidence today, from the Rambam.
So I just make the point to say that the humanists picked up on the Greco-Roman, but they hadn't completely lost it because they did have
Aristotle. Thank you for clarifying what I'm saying. The humanists grew out of the church. They were not a group that came from outside to criticize the church. They were the intellects of the church who grew out of, because the particularly Aristotelian thought from the Greco-Roman had a deep influence on scholasticism. It's just when they began to broaden their horizons, they began to ask deeper questions, and most importantly, for our story, put humanity in the middle. Now, they didn't give up on God, but God's very far away, and human experience is kind of exciting. Poetry, art, the things that people, you know, architecture, the power that the human aesthetic sense offers in not just mundane experience, but also in divine. People here studied or traveled in Italy and seen Renaissance architecture and art, right? It's moving. It's meant to be moving, and most of it is religious art, right? Because that's what art was at the time, but it's of a different quality. If you look at the nature of the presentation of the human body, that's usually one of the most sort of obvious indicators. But what I'm interested here is in thought, because that's what I'm interested in. So we're going to go with that. So in the background to Pico's story are generations and generations, basically since, you know, the school of translation in Toledo in the 11th century in Spain, there have been generations and generations of cooperative efforts between Muslims, Christians, and Jews to translate the works of late antiquity into, ultimately, Latin is the language that makes it accessible to Europeans, right? But what's interesting about, and Pico reads it all, he's fascinated, he's particularly interested in magic, which today may seem a little bit edgy, although apparently he's making a comeback, but in the Renaissance, magic was a corollary of philosophy and science. Alchemy was sort of one of the great aspirations of all the great scientific minds of the Renaissance era. And there were different types of magic. We're not going to go through it, although I had a great time last night looking a bunch of stuff up. That's how I have fun. What's that?
Astrology,
big. We're going to come back to astrology, not right now. But there are a couple of Jewish characters in Pico's story that will help open up for us the Jewish experience in Italy. And again, we want to keep our eyes on the prize, which is what is the alternative method that we're mapping out here for processing the aftermath of the exile? And one of it is to try to join the human experience. That this is a trauma rooted in its particularism, therefore on some level it's best left behind. That may also sound familiar. Right? And so Pico had a couple of teachers. One of them, just because his name is fun to say, Flavius Mithridates. Just the name alone tells you that he was a magician, right? He was an Italian Jewish humanist who converted to Christianity. He was a teacher, just to get a sense of what these people were doing, of Arabic, Hebrew, and Aramaic. The Jews were the cultural bridge for many of these personalities of the Renaissance. He taught Pico Mirandella, and in particular, he is, scholars say, the one who introduced him to Kabbalah. This is why I highlight these things on my notes. Flavius? Mithridates. I'm changing my name. I'm never going to get anywhere with Mike. So, in around 1486, according to my notes at least, Pico had absorbed the knowledge of late antiquity, that he, like I said, the Jews had at least a background role in that. He also was beginning to encounter, as we'll speak about a little bit later when we get to the story of the Italian printing press, some of the works of, say, Middle Ages Jewry. Right? The importance of reading the Bible in its original began to emerge amongst the humanists, of course, because there's a third classic language along with Greek and Latin which contributed to Christian European culture, and that's Hebrew. And in particular, the humanists were often overtly or even just covertly attacking the Vulgate, the Latin translation of the Bible made by Jerome in the 2nd century Common Era, I believe. If it's not, it's the 1st, so I'm off by 100 years, you'll forgive me. But the Vulgate was the way in which the church owned the text of the Bible, because most people were unable to read Latin, certainly the common people, and they fought vehemently against its translation into the vulgar languages, right? There's a word for that. Into the
vernacular.
Thank you, vernacular, that's the word I was looking for. And so part of the humanist effort was to get back to the source and determine, is this a good translation? Right? In order to do that, you don't just have to know Hebrew. You know what else you need to know? You need to know the Radak. You need to be able to read Rashi. Meaning all of the medieval commentators that we today use to try to understand the text, especially what are known as the Pashtanim, like the grammarians, and the ones that are focused on the sort of simple textual meaning, are critical, because the reality is, even if you can read Hebrew, it doesn't mean you know what it says or what it means. So he's getting exposed both indirectly through the translations of late antiquity, directly in his explorations of the Hebrew Bible, and he's introduced to the Kabbalah by the sort of Christian convert, Flavius Mithridates. And like I said, in 1486, which was really the culmination of a couple of years of work, Mithridates actually translated a large selection of Kabbalistic works for Pico's library. Now, what was he after? What was Pico after? So there's a couple of things. One is magic, right? This deep belief that that there was a way in which heaven and earth could be united in a powerful and practical fashion. Remember, alchemy, you're going to turn lead to gold. Right, which was not considered either crazy or heretical, but was simply a branch of science in its day. But that wasn't just it. Because, like I said, Pico was a humanist. A year after he has this encounter, likely multiple-year encounter, with Mithridates and encounters the Kabbalah, and if you think about it, 1486 is a very early age for a non-Jew to be inducted into the secrets of Kabbalah. This is before the expulsion from Spain. It's before Professor Gershom Scholem's classic theory that it was the expulsion which spreads Kabbalah to the world, because the exiles will not only take it with them physically as manuscripts, but they will take it with them so spiritually and psycho-emotionally as the way in which they're able to explain to themselves the great evil which they had just experienced. Right? So we're a few years before that at this point. Right? And we'll come back to this notion of what role the Kabbalah, what becomes Christian Kabbalah, is going to play in the development of Christianity. But for now, it's part of his humanist worldview. Because a year after he has this deep dive into the Kabbalah, Pico publishes what's his most famous work. It was 900, I want to think get that number right. Yes, 900 theses, basically challenging in thought various doctrines of the church and various understandings of both the classical world and the medieval world. And its introduction is known as the Oration on the Dignity of Man. And it's considered by many to be the manifesto of Italian humanism, in thought, of Italian humanism, right? It proclaims the centrality and importance and freedom of man in the universe, right? In my notes here, the professors that I'm reading, they call it a sea change between the medieval mind and the modern mind, with the growth of man's sense of autonomy and dignity. This is what humanism is about. This should be good news for the Jews. Once you start talking about autonomy and human dignity, once you start lifting the horizons of the church, which has a very hierarchical view of where the Jew fits in theologically, just as an important reminder, where does the Jew fit into classic Catholic theology at this point in history, coming out of the Middle Ages? Who was the great thinker who set the mold for the Jew in the Middle Ages? Augustine in the 4th century, right? There was something known as, we'll call it the witness doctrine. Which is that the Jew, on one hand, should be preserved because they're needed as a witness both to the truth of Christian scriptures. Or if I'm going to say that the book of Isaiah is actually about Jesus, and you say to me, where does Isaiah come from? And I say, well, from the Jews. And then you say, where are the Jews? And I say, well, there aren't any left anymore. Your argument falls apart. So the Jews are an important living witness to the veracity of what they call the Old Testament, even though, of course, we read it wrong. That's one thing. What else are we a witness to? Because we're supposed to be kept alive, but in a degraded state. What? Well, we're a witness to what happens when you reject salvation. Our persecution is our own fault for rejecting their Savior. So that model, by the way, so what you're pointing out is a very important discussion we can't go back to, but the parallels between patristic thought and church fathers in the first few centuries of the Common Era and rabbinic thought, there are many of them that go quite closely together, although you might draw different conclusions. But the other piece is that the Jew fits in that worldview. And therefore, the Catholic Church historically was not the driver of persecution of the Jews in the Middle Ages. It was the mob that was the driver. The Catholic Church often, the mob, meaning that the Catholic Church in its official organs was often a defender of the Jews. Not philo-Semitic, but meaning, no, we don't kill them all. We have to preserve them. And it was often either the forces of politics, Ferdinand and Isabella, or the forces of the mob, like in the Crusades, that drew most Jewish blood. It's a complex story. We talked about it last year, but I'm just reminding you that that Augustine's model is actually, to some degree, a comfortable model. And we're going to see that the Jews, in many ways, will want to get back to that. Because you know what else Augustine does? He draws a hard and fast line between Jew and non-Jew. And who does that serve? The Jews, for sure. There's no mistaking it. Humanism, I mean, it's great. Pico Mirandella is talking about, where's this quote, right? The elevation of the autonomy and the dignity of humanity, freedom of man in the universe. And who's his primary teacher of Kabbalah? An apostate. Right? And so there's going to be a challenge to classic religious identity in humanism, which is why it actually will also be, I should just tell you now, another short-lived response amongst Jews to the tragedy of the expulsion. So Pico is very interesting. Like I said, he has these 900 theses. He ends up actually going to Rome to engage in a public debate because many of his theses are condemned by Pope Innocent the Eighth. But the one more piece from his thought, which is important for us to take, is that Pico was a synthetic thinker, by which I don't mean he was interested in carbon polymers. I mean that he actually was all about putting pieces together, and that he had a belief that since Plato, there was one, what's it called? It's called Prisia Theologia. There's one pristine theology. There's one true theology, which is the subtext for all thought in late antiquity and Christianity. And what's the keystone for uncovering its ultimate truth? The Kabbalah. That somehow the Jews, because where does this truth come from? From Moses. But it's been hidden. No one understood. This is a very Christian attitude. No one understood what Moses was actually saying. And somehow it made its way, I haven't done enough reading of his work, it made its way into Greek culture as well, through Plato, but he feels he now has, through the Kabbalah, becomes the keystone for uncovering the truth of Christian doctrine. And this is the place where the bite comes in, the Jews don't see coming. Because on one hand, he is as liberal as he gets. His home is filled with Jewish scholars, not just apostates. Right? There are other major Jewish scholars, depending on how things go in the next 20 minutes, maybe we'll talk about some of them, maybe not. But the, at least one I would like to touch. But ultimately, this is a Christian humanism. His goal is to once again appropriate Jewish culture in service of his mission, which is still rooted in the notion of, if not superseding, but sort of revealing the truth of the Jewish doctrine. Right? And so, and by the way, magic, let's not leave that out. I mean, he is interested in turning lead to gold. Yes?
He's interested in revealing the truth to both Christians and Jews?
Yes, meaning Christians live in ignorance of the truth of what they have, and Jews just live in ignorance. Yes, and in fact, this whole world of Christian Kabbalists, some of them will be philo-Semitic, meaning some of them will just think, wow, the Jews are pretty cool, and we got what to learn from them. But they are by far the minority. Many of them will begin a process, which will become familiar in modernity, between separating between Jewish wisdom and the historical embodiment of the Jew. Meaning, oh, I love your books. I could do without your community. This is the era, by the way, in which the first works of what we would call Jewish sociology, not really, anthropology, begin to appear. Meaning, written works that are about the behaviors of the Jews. So on one hand, this is a normalizing liberal force. The Jew just becomes another community. Remember, at this point, sailors are coming back with reports about Hinduism and Buddhism and various African customs. And furthermore, the level of trade and communication between the Muslim world and the Christian world is sort of, well, relatively speaking, booming. So therefore, there's a European human experience. And they can conceptualize the Jews as like just another like flavor of humanity. On the other hand, there is something which the Christians want, which is that Jewish wisdom. And consciously or not, what they're trying to do is separate it from its historic embodiment, which if those of us have been learning together for the last year, or those who may have some familiarity with the history otherwise knows, this is consistent with the nature of the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. Is that from the time of the Pauline scriptures, the idea of the need to divorce the wisdom of the Torah from the historic embodiment of the Jewish people has been a theme throughout. And it doesn't usually end well for the Jews. That was what you were thinking about. Well, it's not, he didn't really do anything new, I hear that. He didn't do anything new for him. I can't be bothered with that. He didn't do anything new for him. At the same time, opening up the humanist door and making statements about the dignity of humanity and the autonomy, those won't go away. When are they going to make their comeback? Yeah, the French Revolution, what we know as real modernity. This is early modernity. We've still got one foot in the Middle Ages. You know who's really going to find those statements moving in our story? Moses Mendelssohn. Right? And this idea that the Jew could be a citizen. Now we're going to come, because at the end of the story we got to talk about the ghetto. Because if Pico Mirandella is making these statements in 1487, 30 years later, slightly less, the Jews of Venice are put into the ghetto. And we'll talk about whether that's good news for the Jews or not, or even better than humanism, perhaps. But his story is so rich. But really, the piece I want to sort of like extract out of it is, what's the Jewish experience of humanism? Meaning, it's all well and good that Pico's taking the Kabbalah. And by the way, the Kabbalah, I'm not going to map it out now. When we get back to Europe, maybe we'll pick it up again. But the Kabbalah will have a deep influence also in the development of the Protestant movements. In development of the Protestant movements. There's a strain of Christian mysticism which will grow out of Kabbalistic thought, largely because where they meet is it's what's known as Neoplatonism. And actually, let's define Neoplatonism, because that will give us a bridge to Leon Ebreo, who I actually want to speak at a little bit more length about. Neoplatonism historically is a Platon, like Plato, right? Neoplatonism is a philosophical movement. If you look it up in the dictionaries, you'll see that it existed around, say, the late antiquity, like the end of the Western Roman Empire, say, 4th, 5th century of the Common Era. But it keeps making a comeback. Like, you'll find it in what's known as Gnostic thought. You'll find it in medieval Christian thought. It has a deep influence, except if you ask Jews, on Jewish mystical thought. What is it, and why does it keep so? And by the way, unbeknownst to many Jews today who think of themselves as like mystic Kabbalists, many of them are Neoplatonists of a Jewish nature, which I have no problem with, right? So what is it? First of all, this may sound familiar, Neoplatonism is focused on the idea of the one. That in reality, there is only one thing. And that human soul comes into being to allow for a relationship. But that ultimately the human soul is one ray of light from the same source. Where does the world come from? The world is an emanation. Right? The difference between an emanation and a creation is an emanation is not actually separate from source. It is only experienced as such. Anybody who's done like Kabbalah 101, this should be starting to sound quite familiar. That there is a difference between idea and matter in the Platonic sense, or body and soul in the religious, but that ultimately they're brought into the world so that there can be an experience of harmony. Right? If you have no body, you can't experience. Right? There's harmony is when two things join in right relationship, correct? So without separation, there's no harmony. You understand? No? That if I only had one note, you could never have harmony. You must have two, and it's in their right relationship that you experience that emergence of a third idea, which actually can't exist without either. To put it in simpler language, think of a relationship that you really cherish in your life, right? It couldn't exist without the other. But it doesn't belong to you and it doesn't belong to them. It actually exists between you. That make more sense? So therefore, even though it is, on one hand, a dualist worldview, it's not the dualist worldview of which dismisses matter and only worships idea, or dismisses body and only worships soul, but rather says that actually they're both critical elements in order that harmony can be experienced. Evil has no real existence to the Neoplatonists. There's only good, because there's only one, but what is experienced as evil is imperfection. Because life is a process. Right? And last but certainly not least, the soul is eternal, and through contemplation and right ideas, it can actually build its connection to the infinite in this world. But when you die, you basically stop at whatever level you reached while you were alive. So therefore, the ultimate goal of the Neoplatonists is not only right conception, you've got to understand the world, but it's contemplation, a drawing closer and closer in an ecstatic experience of love. Sounds good, yeah? This, by the way, if you're familiar with thinkers from the Middle Ages, like Ibn Gabriel, who was a very important Jewish thinker whose works were appropriated as Christian thought in Fons Vital into the Catholic Church and then resurfaced when they realized actually the original was not written in Latin, was in Hebrew. Other thinkers down through the ages,
Kabbalistic thought, and we'll have a discussion when we get to the Arizal in Sfat of what role Neoplatonism might have played there. Why does it matter for us? Because it's a cultural bridge that Christians and Jews are somehow both working on the same playing field. So therefore, when certain exiles from Spain make their way to Italy, they will encounter this culture. So we're going to pick up the story with Don Yitzchak Abravanel. Remember we quoted him last week, right? Don Yitzchak, of course, was the finance minister of the King of Spain during the expulsion. He had previously played the same role in Portugal and was forced to flee. He was originally in Portugal, went to Spain, and then he actually didn't go back with the exiles to Portugal. He might have stopped in Portugal, but he ultimately made his way to Naples. Right? He carries with him a deeply messianic worldview and a disgust with kings. I'm going to use a different color because it doesn't look like that one's working so well. Got to give him his title, Don. He's not, his name isn't Don. That's a title of like Mr. or like, I'm just. Now, how you spell Abravanel is like a big machloket. Abravanel, fine. Abravanel. It's a big, I see you already heard the argument happen there, right? You also see it spelled. That's because if you're familiar with Hebrew writing. No, hang on. Yeah. You could pronounce it either way. And different ways of spelling it, whatever. For our purposes, he's really the last major biblical commentator of the Middle Ages. Fantastic work. Highly encourage you. Interesting that he often will both draw from Christian sources or at least respond to the questions raised by Christian scholars. Right? He makes his way to Italy. Has not such an easy end to his life, but he really, in many ways, will carry the seeds of messianism out of the destruction into Italian Jewish culture. But I'm more interested in his son. His son, we've spoken a little bit about him. We spoke about him at length last year. Can't go backwards, even though it seems I have a unique ability to do that, right? And so Yehuda Leon Abravanel, he was at his father's side when they served the king of Portugal in the 80s. That's the 1480s. They fled to Spain together where they served Ferdinand and Isabella, and they left together basically on the wings of the storm in 1492, whereas the father went more or less straight to Naples, even though they ended up moving around a lot. Right? His son took up a life of wandering. It is a sad but important note to remind you that he actually, Yehuda Leon Abravanel, sent his baby child to Portugal where he thought that the Jews were going to find safety. In the end of the day, the son was seized and baptized, and it left a mark on him that shows up through his writings through the rest of his life. Just remember that there's a tragedy in the background. So like I said, he travels throughout Italy, eventually settling in Genoa, and in his wanderings throughout Italy, he found a completely different spirit than the one he had left behind in Spain. Don't forget that the non-Jewish spirit in Spain was what we would today call Catholic supremacy. Right? Ferdinand and Isabella were the Catholic monarchs, and they were interested in a very powerful and very narrow construction of both the Catholic faith and Christian culture, but he was exposed to Renaissance humanism, and wherever he went, every city-state of Italy, ruled by this duke or that prince or whomever, right, he would associate with the humanist circles so much so that he became known as Leon Ebreo, Leon the Hebrew. Right? It was a known personality, and what's interesting in my eyes, it was during this time amongst the humanists where he first of all met Pico Mirandella. There's a bit of a debate about it, but it seems in terms of the majority opinion amongst the scholars that I've been seeing, that indeed that they had some interaction, and most importantly that one of the pieces that came out of this interaction was ultimately the decision taken by Leon to write down the Dialogues of Love. Dialoghi d'amore. I don't speak Italian, so you can make fun of my pronunciation later. What? It was fine? Oh, great. It was actually only published posthumously in 1535, but he obviously wrote it while he was still alive. And for us, it's important for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is a classic work of Renaissance humanism. It's a work on love, and not just so-called Platonic philosophical love, but also physical love, the continuum of the love one might feel for an object, to the one might feel for one's lover, to the one love might feel one might feel for God. It's a series of dialogues on the subject of love. It has a tremendous influence down through the ages, translated into multiple languages, goes through multiple printings, so much so in our story that you will find it on the bookshelf of Spinoza, right, in the 17th century in Amsterdam. And at this point, scholars feel that it had a tremendous impact on Spinoza's notion of divine love, which we'll come to when we get to his story. It brings together Eliyahu, the prophet, Moshe, Enoch, the sort of like biblical midrashic, you know, pseudo-epigraphic character, right, John the Baptist, Aristotle, Plato, the Rambam, Ibn Gabiro, meaning it's the whole wealth of human knowledge that he knows in service of the idea that it is the intellect's duty to contemplate God. And once it's perfected, it will then unite with God and attain to such a union, right, with God Most High as proves our intellect to be rather part of the essence of God than understanding of merely human form. It is a classic work of Neoplatonism, and becomes one of the important ones, even for non-Jewish circles, to this very day. If you happen to study Renaissance humanism, you can't get away with not reading it. Now that's interesting, it's fascinating, and in many ways it is a response that you know, in the face of the evil of the exile and the personal experience, let's remember that, not the conceptual one, but like Ibn Verga, the personal experience, what does he say? God is love, evil is imperfection, and humanity is capable of more. Right? It's a fantastically optimistic worldview, but also terribly naive. Right? Terribly naive, not because of his belief in humanity. Please don't get me wrong. I'm not a cynic. It's just that there is a challenge when a minority culture encounters a majority culture at all times, which is simply getting absorbed into the majority. You know, there's a claim that he converts. It's based on the title page of the second and third editions, which was printed already in the 1540s in Venice, which gives the title as Dialogues of Love Composed by Dr. Leon of Hebrew Heritage, who later became Christian. His son was forcibly baptized. He never saw his son again. Right? Actually, scholars have pretty much proven that this is a falsehood, that he never converted, based both on the contents of the book and also on the fact that Jewish communities continued to print and give, what are the letters at the front, haskamot are called? There's a word for that in English.
Approbations.
You guys are good. What would I do without you? So you say it's a printer's claim. What's the big deal? I want you to understand what's happening here. Is that humanism is Christian humanism. And it's true that for Leon Hebreo personally, this was a response to the tragedy of the expulsion. And it's a beautiful one. We call this up-leveling. Oh, you want to drag me down into the pits of the disgusting size of human darkness? I'll tell you that they're not actually real. I will push that evil into the corners and the shadows where it belongs, and I will tell you that God is love. But what happens is that ultimately the majority culture within which he does this appropriates him. Because once he's dead, okay, so scholars in the 20th century are proving that he never actually converted. But you know what? Every Christian in the 16th and 17th century who read that book was certain that this book reinforced their view. Just like Pico Marandella told you, that the truth of Jewish knowledge proves Christianity. We know this story. Those of us who were together last year, we spoke about how the arguments within the church and the Jews began as biblical textual arguments, what we call the hermeneutic battle, who's reading the story in the right way that'll get us redemption. And then they became, the stubborn Jews, the oral law is preventing them from seeing the light, so we got to get rid of the Talmud. And then it became, truth is, the Jewish law or Jewish oral tradition itself proves the truth of Christianity. And now, the Kabbalah in the hands of many, not all, but many of the Christian Kabbalists, and even in the humanists, is doing the exact same thing. So there's a very important question here. Is that what do you do in the face of a welcoming culture? Right? Ibn Verga knew what to do in the face of a hostile culture, just like Machiavelli. Figure out what works. He didn't have the power that the princes of the Italian city-states had, but at least he had the Jewish mind. Leon Abreu represents, again, another minor but powerful contribution, which is you up-level in the face of conflict. I'm not going to give in to the darkness of humanity. The danger there is that you are ripe for appropriation and absorption into the majority culture. Right? And then what have you done? Even mind you, maybe if you're in service of humanity and not in service of being a Jew, it's important to remember. If it's not important to remain as a Jew, then what you've done is succeeded. Right? And I'm not personally taking sides on it. I think it's pretty obvious that I think it's important to be a Jew, but meaning I'm not taking a judgmental stance. That is a legitimate historical response to the experience of persecution and tragedy, which is that why do I need this Jewish thing anyway? Right? And to take all of the wealth of 2,000, 3,000 years of culture and history and knowledge and to basically enter at the highest level, he enters at the highest level of humanist culture. What's happening to the bulk of the Jews at this time? It's a great question. I think it'll be better answered in the next section. But the simple answer to your question is the bulk of the Jews have no access to this level of knowledge. They don't have the wealth to have the books. They don't have the sort of cultural intelligence information to bridge the gaps. Right? We're talking at the elite level, which is an important caveat that you're bringing out. Yeah. So Pico Mirandella is exemplary of this group of people who learned to read Hebrew from the Jews. In the original. And this brings us to a short piece, because I want to end, actually, if we have time. We might have time with the story of David Ruvaini, who fits right in here. Say, yeah, Aviva. Pico or? Ooh, I'm guessing in around 1520. Do I have the actual dates of his life here? I don't, but if someone wants to Google it, because I have written my notes that the dialogues were published posthumously in 1535, so I can say it was before that. But I usually put down the dates here. I apologize. It was after 1521. Yeah, because I remember this. That's why I didn't write it down. There's questions. He disappears, and the last sort of like place they can pin him down in life is 1521. Right. So there's a couple other pieces. We're just mapping Italian Jewry so we can wrap it up and put it aside. But one of actually extremely important contribution overall of the Italian Jewry and non-Jew, frankly, to Jewish culture, and that's the printing press. Now, we spoke about the printing press. Of course, Gutenberg's press is, of course, not the first press ever. The Europeans didn't create the technology of movable type, right? But they did perfect it, right? Gutenberg's Bible published when? 1452? No, I think it's earlier. I have it in my mind in the 1440s, but what matters for us right now is it mid-15th century, well before the expulsion. At this point, it seems that the origins of Jewish printing were likely in Iberian Spain. It's not really Spain yet, that's why they call it Iberian. In the Iberian Peninsula, pre-expulsion, that's where the beginnings of the Jewish printing experiment went. But it really catches hold in two places, in Venice and in the Ottoman Empire. So in I want to just touch Venice because it has a big impact, and then we'll end with a fun story. Questions or comments? We've got about 25 minutes. Questions or comments up till now in terms of, yeah. Yeah, well, and this will be a theme of Jewish history. Hell hath no disillusionment. Yeah, because they stole him after he was dead. It's a posthumous baptism. Yeah. Read the papers. And this is the question. Listen. this is the question. Are the Jews just like everybody else, only more so? One of the sort of catchphrases that we used to explain the rise of Jews within Spanish Iberian culture last year, you guys remember what it was? The Jews are excellent servants. They're diligent, loyal, talented, and easily discarded. Right? And that makes a perfect servant. Because everybody else has a power base that you end up getting, you know, istabachti, like I'm all complicated in your thing. Whereas the Jews, like I get everything I need, and then, oof. Right? That's going to be a theme.
The Abreu story is so much worse.
Yes. And this is another reflective of another of the problematic relationships between Christianity and Judaism, is that on some level, the first printer that decided to say he later became a Christian was probably just trying to sell books. Let's get that straight. He was probably just trying to sell books. It's going to be a more popular book if it's a book about the dialogues of divine love by a Jew who became a Christian. Like, ooh, I want to read that one. But what he does effectively is he reinforces a Christian narrative that any thinking Jew ultimately comes around to Christianity. I can't psychoanalyze him from this distance, but I will tell you this, is a question that everybody has to ask themselves, is that even if you run the risk of being culturally appropriated like Leon Hebrea, does that mean that that type of response to tragedy, which is to up-level and insist on the ultimate power of divine love and the goodness of humanity, is a bad idea? Because what he's asserting is a very important truth of human and, he says, divine experience. Because the alternative is retreat. And we're going to see that actually this is largely the tactic that the Jews will take going into early modernity, which is circle the wagons, go deeper into a mystic worldview, which focuses on the particularity of the Jews, and hope that the humanists don't breach the walls of the ghetto. Because there's as much, you know what? When the Cossacks, to mix metaphors, breach the walls of the ghetto, it's bad news for your body, but it's good news for your soul. We'll speak about this going forward in time. Why? Because it reinforces a narrative that we're the Jews, you're not, we're superior to you. How do I know? Because you just raped, pillaged, and plundered my village. You're an animal. So we're not like you. When the humanists breach the walls of the ghetto, you know what happens? Gosh, they're just so nice. And not only that, they're really intelligent. And the truth is, we're speaking the same language. And you know what? It's a heck of a lot easier to be a Christian humanist than a Jewish one. Because that the sort of like the iron fist inside the silk glove there is not gone yet. Christian Europe, even at its most humanist, is not a tolerant society in the 21st century sense. And so therefore, there's always a subtle pressure, plus the narrative pressure, which is that, you know, you're sitting around with a bunch of the highest level intellects you can encounter in humanity as far as they're concerned, whatever. I'm not getting into the whole cultural argument thing, right? And you're speaking the same language about divine love and Neoplatonism and the intellectual history from Elijah to Moses to, and everybody else agrees on that one thing that you don't agree on. At what point do you lose the ability to just withstand the social, psychological, intellectual, and spiritual pressure there? And so therefore, I want to, you know, go back to the printing, but just keep that in mind. Wait, you know, is it better for the Jews that the Cossacks breach the walls of the ghetto or that the humanists do, right? And who, therefore, are those walls serving? Okay, a word on printing, and just we'll just put a finger on the ghetto, so to speak, and then depending on, maybe we'll tell the Ruvaini story at the beginning of next class. We'll see. So the role that printing in Italy, and particularly in Venice, plays is phenomenal. A little bit of the backstory, of course, the history of Jewish texts is complex. We're not going to go into it all over, but it's important to remember that historically, an authoritative text was very difficult to separate from its author in its lifetime and its teachers after its lifetime. What do I mean? So if I asked you to copy this text, what would you do? Now you pull out your phone, right? You guys are already 20th century, you know? You're behind the times. So, right, but the idea is our relationship to text is in its absolute nature. text has integrity by definition. In the pre-printing era, that simply wasn't true. Just not. I mean, we had to create a whole category of people to preserve the text of the Torah. It's a whole culture of a scribal culture and the sanctity and the insistence. So that's important to remember for the context of the emergence of the printing press, which is where this association between text and integrity will really come from with most people. Why? It's not just because of scribal error. Okay, Mela, people make mistakes, and different people have good handwriting and bad handwriting, so two manuscript works simply don't look the same. That we all know. But you should understand how the halachic discourse works. You guys are all familiar, I hope, with the page of a Gemara, right? There's a text. Whoa, don't give it away. Right? Right? There's a text in the middle. Commentary is very clearly laid out around it. And just visually, you can see what's primary and what's secondary. It's a very powerful assertion of authority. Whereas in sort of Middle Ages texts, you had marginal notes, meaning I'm reading the Or Zeruah, one of the important halakhic works of late Middle Ages in Ashkenaz. I'm reading the Or Zeruah, and I'm taking notes. But you know who I am? The Or Zeruah is dead. Who am I? I'm the halakhic authority of my town, or maybe of this region, et cetera. And so I'm making these notes, and one of my students or some member of my community comes to me and says, well, what does the law teach there? First of all, you know what he doesn't do? He doesn't pull Mishnah Berurah off the shelf and say, Rabbi, how do I understand this passage in Mishnah Berurah? He comes to me as a human being and says, what is the law in this case? And therefore, I can essentially tell him anything I want. Now, not speaking cynically here, but it's very important to remember that the posture of the oral law is that the teacher is more important than the text. Text is problematic in all oral traditions, and we're not going to go back through it, but we've had extensive discussions over the years over the tragedy of the writing down the oral law, but it exists. But one of the ways in which we keep a marginal relationship to it is because the teacher ultimately is the interpreter. And furthermore, you know what happens with those marginal notes when I hand them on to my students? They become part of the text often. And they creep, in fact, it's like a big thing in manuscripts, especially if you've learned Ashkenazi. It's a very well established in Ashkenazi, basically because of the way the manuscript work has been done. But like the Haga'ot HaSmag, the Haga'ot Or Zeruah, things were originally written as marginal notes, creep their way into the text, and therefore they gain the authority of previous generations, which is one of the ways you can have the evolution of law without any sense of disruption of culture. It's very important to remember that one of the strongest tendencies of the human mind is to believe that the way things are now is the way they've always been. Even in the face of massive evidence. Anybody feel like it's odd that smartphone you have in your pocket that gives you access to all that information? Maybe you had an initial experience that it was odd, but after a while, you know what it becomes? Completely normal. And it's the way in which you think of the world. And then you have to struggle with what's known as historical anachronism, which is, how do I not project the way I know the world now back on the way we looked at it 15 years ago? We're not talking about ancient history, right? It's a tremendous problem, which has to do with a very high degree of self-awareness and historical culture, which doesn't exist in medieval Jewish culture. Therefore, it's a very important tool of adaption without any loss of continuity, because I can say that what the law says is what it's always said, even though if you compare, like we do today, the manuscripts of the Or Zeruah from the 15th century to the manuscripts of the 13th century, you'll discover that somebody took some notes there in the 14th century and they made their way into the body of the text. But nobody knew that. And the people who did weren't being cynical. They saw that as an organic textual process. All that changes with the advent of printing. Because suddenly, in the late 15th century, in Venice in particular, you get one of the first, if not the first, major, because what's major, right? Printing house is the Cencino printing house, right? Joshua Solomon Cencino, in 1484, issues the first work from his press, which is, anybody know? First tractate of the Talmud ever printed, Brachot, right? He and his sons innovate a very important element, something we're familiar with today, is putting Rashi and the Tosafists, they're actually a descendant, I wrote down who it was, of Moshe Mispire, one of the Tosafists. They were the ones who decide that putting the Tosafists on the page of the Gemara, if you're familiar with the Gemara, was an essential act. Right? And Rashi, they give birth to this notion of Rashi's script. Rashi didn't write in Rashi's script. He didn't. He didn't. Rashi's script is an invention of, it's not clear whether the printers invented it or earlier people who had been taking marginal notes invented it. Why is Rashi's script important? To differentiate between primary text and commentary. When you write two things on the same page, you want to be able to see very quickly the hierarchy. Right? And so the visual power of the page of the Gemara, is pioneered by Cencino. We'll mention Daniel Bomberg, who follows in his footsteps immediately after him. But from this point on, anybody here learn Daf Yomi? And daily, you know? And people talk about Surat Adaf, how important it is, the page, the shape of the page. This is an invention of the printers of the 15th century. Late 15th century. No such thing existed pre-printing press, just perforce, logically speaking, it didn't exist. Furthermore, there was no pagination of the Gemara before the printing press. No pagination. Like today, it's on Daf 116b. But if you look into the Rishonim, the early medieval authorities, they don't cite Dapim. They cite chapters. Right? Why? Because there were no consistent pages. There were chapters, but no consistent pages. Now, lest you think that this is a small act, right? That's just one element. I'll give you another couple. So Daniel Bomberg. So Cencino begins that process, but basically because of their family history, the son, whose name right now evades me, it's whatever, come back to me. The son kind of abandons the original press and then travels throughout Italy and the Ottoman Empire, basically like Johnny, he's the Johnny Appleseed of Jewish printing. Cencino, yes. Cencino's Jewish. He's basically the Johnny Appleseed of Jewish printing. He, like, wherever he goes, he's like, here, I'll teach you how to do this. I'll teach you how to do this. And he, like, little printing presses just pop up in his wake. But the real powerhouse is a non-Jew named Daniel Bomberg, who really is, properly speaking, the father of printing and publishing when it comes to sort of the works of Jewish religious books. He's born in Antwerp. He's a Christian. What's that? No, it wasn't art school. Though if you read the art school history, they'll tell you that it was. And to this day, the standard, people talk about the Venice standard edition of the Talmud, is the Bomberg 1523 edition. I saw, actually, when I was doing research, that someone just bought an edition of this Talmud, original, for $9.3 million. Yeah, huh? It took him 4 years. Unlike Cencino, who was only able to access scattered tractates, masechtot, Bomberg did the research to get the entire Babylonian and Yerushalmi, the so-called Palestinian Talmud. He also was able, through the intervention of sort of like high place political friends, to get the permission of the Pope to print it, because up until this point, the Talmud had been largely suppressed. Right. And this is Pope Leo X, who was in general favorable to the Jews relative to other popes. He was also a huge patron of study of all forms. He's a humanist. 1521, he's one of the humanist popes. So the power of what we're talking about here is that, well, I'll give it to you fully. So picture the page of the Gemara. He also is the first person to print a Mikro Gedolot. Right, the rabbinic commentary, which in the same way shows the text of the Torah or the Tanakh in the middle with the commentaries around it, right? And this is a pattern which will then be followed by the halachic works. And I want you to understand the power of the hierarchy there, the visual impact of what happens when the central text, the commentaries, which commentaries matter. I mean, if you've ever learned in Shulchan Aruch, everybody knows, where do you look if you want to know the most important information after the center page, right? So this upper two corners. Depends on Shach and the Taz, if you're running your Adea, or the Sma and the Taz, you know, like, meaning that visual placement, which is ultimately a printer's decision, right, is a very powerful text, which also begins in strange ways to undermine the rabbinic hierarchy, right? Because now the rabbi can't just tell you what they think. They are subject to the text. Remember, the fixed texts play a very problematic role in a tradition of oral law, which even though the oral law begins to be undermined in the time of the Mishnah, the second turning point in its evolution in many ways will be the printing press. And the next, just to project down the line so you can appreciate what's coming, the next problem is precedent. Right? Because the precedent, when the Rashba, Rav Shlomo Ibn Aderet, 14th century Christian Spain, very important halachic authority of his day, one of the most prolific writers of responsa in Jewish history. When the Rashba wrote, he hadn't seen much of what many of the other contemporary thinkers wrote in his day. Why? Because the manuscripts weren't that well distributed. Some were. I mean, like the Rambam's Mishneh Torah is famous for spreading across the globe very quickly. But the Rashba did not have access to everything. So therefore, the Rashba wrote in reference to whatever he read and his own thought. But suddenly, once the printing press is online and we begin slowly but surely the mass production, the weight of precedent is going to become very powerful and even somewhat crushing. What's coming down the line soon enough are the legal codes. Right? The great one of the Shulchan Aruch is going to be published before the 16th century is over. And I think the first full edition was in like 1574, 1575. We'll nail it down. It might have been 10 years earlier. But the Shulchan Aruch literally means what? Set table. You see how this is consistent with this whole momentum. There was no set table before. There were these books and that books. There was that rabbi. There was this community. And now what we're going to start to do is bring together the corpus of Ashkenazic and Sephardic law, East and West, mixing together in one page, which aren't culturally relative anymore, but are asserting themselves as absolute. Right? And you're going to do it in a printed form, which has a tremendous visual power and cultural weight, and will begin to mass produce what we know as Jewish culture and modernity, religious Jewish culture and modernity. So the impact of these two printing presses, Cicino and Bamberg's press, in Jewish history really can't be understated. Last but certainly not least, it's just a fun fact, that chapter and verse uniformity within the Hebrew Bible are a product of 13th century Christian monks. And it will be Bamberg in his Mikrot Gedolot, in his rabbinic compendium of commentaries around the Bible, who universalizes it. That the chapter and verse notation that we're all familiar with today aren't organic to the Hebrew Bible and are universalized by a Christian printer in the 16th century. Excellent. Maybe that will help us wrap this all up, because I can see now I won't do justice to Ruvaini's story in the last few minutes we have. Why? Why does he do it? First of all, it's a business. It's a business. Can't ignore the fact money. Jews, just like I've told you guys the joke, when I asked my brother, why does the New York Times write so much about Jews? He says to me, who do you think buys newspapers? So Jews are literate, and they have a literary culture, and they will buy books, they will print them. But it's more than that, because the truth is Bamberg runs a lot of risks and does incredibly intense research, working first together with an apostate, which makes his first edition of the Mikro Gedolo, people are kind of iffy about it, but eventually drafting major rabbinic scholars to work as his editors. Rabbi Chia Meir ben David, who was the Av Beit Din, was the head of the religious court in Venice, was the project manager for the production of the Talmud, working together with Bamberg in the printing house. So why does he do it? Because Bamberg is, as a Christian, a believer in what we call Christian Hebraism. It is critical. The business side doesn't hurt anybody. But, you know, for business, he's not going to run the risk of asking the Pope for the permission to write a work, to print a work, sorry, that's been suppressed for, you know, potentially centuries, depending on where you're looking in Europe, right? He has a belief that the Christians need access, because the expansion of this knowledge, and also that the Jews should have access to their knowledge, because there's a messianism, which we're going to speak about next class. We'll go on to the full-on messianic. I promise you, I'll get as messianic as I ever get in the next class. There's one last thing. It's a very interesting side note, and we'll end on this. If we end 2 minutes early, that's fine. The phenomenon of censorship in printing is a well-known phenomenon, and people are often familiar with the fact that, particularly in the early modern era, when the printing presses were really getting off the ground, that the church supposedly sort of dealt a very heavy hand in censorship. That was true in many cases in the Talmud, because the Talmud was considered to be problematic. But the truth of the matter is, it seems from the evidence, most censors were fairly light. Their goal was not to suppress Jewish theology, rather to protect Christian sensibilities. They weren't interested in printing things that people that were like blatantly anti-Christian. But what is interesting from this respect, and I think it gives you some insight into Bomberg's, and it's really where the sort of Christian Hebraists, the humanists, and perhaps even the Jews meet, is that what came out of these printing houses oftentimes, just picture it. Here you have in the room a Christian printer, Av Beit Din of Venice, like a major rabbinic authority, probably a couple apostates, because why? Because they're a very critical bridge, both culturally and linguistically, who are trying to work out the sides of their personalities. In my opinion, you can never leave psychology out of these things. Plus, whoever the printer, the guy who's moving the type, and you know, they're all in there trying to craft a product which is accessible to everyone. And in many ways, what they do is they create a Jewish culture which is usable in modernity. Right? It's usable to the Jews because it's got the authentic tradition. It's usable to the Christians because they've taken the edges off of it in a way in which they can access it. Is it authentic to either, to neither, to both? Well, that's a big question. And as a people who has watched our tradition evolve through many, many things, what is authentic is a very hard question to answer. Shlomo Ibn Verga was an authentic Jew. His historiographic response and his belief that there was a natural causality to history is hard to call inauthentic to his experience. Leon Hebreo was about as authentic a Jew as you're going to get, and yet we saw that once he was gone, it was very easy for Christianity to co-opt his culture, right? And so these printing houses and the standard edition of the Gemara is printed by a Christian Hebraist printer in Venice. So what will be the authentic Jewish culture that will go forward in its encounter with modernity? Well, we're going to speak next class about the more reactionary messianic approach to authentic culture, which involves building walls rather than bridges. But we're going to stop there for now, and we will pick up next week.
This was a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To learn more about sponsoring a podcast, please contact Jamie at pardes.org.